This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing. My name is Patsy Gill. The romance fiction genre accounts for over 1 billion of sales every year. My guest this week is Mary Bly, who, as Eloisa James, takes a big chunk of that money, the best-selling author of 24 historical romances. Eloisa.
Hello, how are you?
Thanks for joining me from England today.
It's my pleasure.
They called Barbara Cartland the Queen of Romance, but with your Desperate Duchess series, I think we should call you the Duchess of Historical Romance. Are you overwhelmed when you think about having over 6 million books in print and in Kindle in 20 countries?
I don't hear anything. I have to say that I'm surprised. These things, I think everyone who's a writer out there who's published realizes that things snowball and they take so long. I've been writing for so long that it never felt as if I made a huge leap. It was always incremental, tiny, tiny, tiny steps.
Well, I'm looking at Publishers Weekly, and I see that your latest book, which was released by HarperCollins, Four Nights with the Duke, is again on the bestseller list. Do you keep track of how many bestsellers you've had?
Sure. You know, it's not something you ever get sick of, that call from your editor saying what number you are in the New York Times in particular.
Well, you know, I was thinking about it. I was thinking, you know, what you should do is you should have a necklace made for yourself, and then like a diamond for every New York Times bestseller, and maybe an emerald for every USA bestseller. And then, you know, for every one, every list, you have a different one. And, you know, In no time, at the rate you're going, you're going to be covered head to toe in jewels.
Well, what we did was, the first time I hit the New York Times, my husband and I went out and bought a big chair, a big easy, you know, a big reading in chair, and that felt like a very lovely present.
Oh, that's
not really a jewelry person.
Well, you know, I thought the premise for Four Nights with the Duke was, you know, was particularly appropriate for you, you know, because you have your heroine dreaming of becoming a published author, which of course was rather unusual in those days because your book is set in 1787 in England. How did you come up with that idea? It's very clever.
Well, she actually is a published author. She's a bestseller. Yeah. And she's late with her next book. And of course, that comes right out of real life for me. But it's also, the reason I thought of it was not only because I wanted to ground the heroine in something that I knew so much about, but because there actually were quite a few women published at the time who were making a lot of money, and we never hear about them. You know, we only hear about Jane Austen. But there were a lot of people writing what is called silver fork novels, which were about, you know, a millinery, a girl who makes hats, falling in love with the Duke, and they sold out on the first day sometimes. So I wanted to sort of bring that part of women's writing more into prominence.
So who were some of those writers?
Well, Glasgow was one of the famous ones. I'm afraid that, you know, they're sort of lost to history.
They're not printed anymore, not like Jane Austen.
No, I went and read a bunch of them on Google Books, and they're not very good, I hate to say. I don't think they'd get a market now, which is why I can't remember their names.
Well, you know, your heroine, Mia, it's not your typical, romance character, in that she's not, isn't tall and willowy, and which I understand that you're tall and willowy, but so how did you decide on the sort of physical look of Mia?
Well, I decided I wanted to have her very humiliated when she was 15, when the the man who will be the Duke overhears that she's written this love poem for him, and these boys, you know, make fun of it, and she overhears it. And one of them compares her breasts to cabbages. And I knew that I wanted to be writing about a woman who's marked by that cruel comment very early in her life and sort of is unable to shed that image of her body as unattractive. So from that, she became a small, curvy person, because that's the kind of person I wanted to be writing about, someone who was genuinely felt bad about her body and came to a very different feeling by the end of the novel.
Well, you're a great proponent of romance fiction in general, I don't know if people realize it is such a large part of the fiction market, over 20%, and you believe that it empowers women who both write it and read it?
I do. I believe that there's a tremendous amount of women who are earning a working wage or far above who are writing romance. It is, as you say, a powerhouse within the industry. We tend to support a lot of the literature that is published but doesn't make any money. And then the other side, there's been a lot of scholarly work on romance. It's really interesting that looks at how it empowers women from a sexual point of view, in that these are books in which women's concerns and women's eroticism is taken extremely seriously and treated with a lot of respect. And that is not true of a great deal of literature that's published today or in the past.
Well, you appear in Laurie Kahn's documentary, Love Between the Covers, which is an exploration of romance fiction in general. Can you tell us about it? I think it was premiered at the Library of Congress.
It did, yeah. It was very exciting. It premiered at the Library of Congress, and it just showed this last weekend at the Toronto Film Fest. And it was invited to be one of the featured films. So that's very exciting. And I've been hearing from people who saw it all week. So, I think it's a wonderful thing. She does documentaries on women's work. And this is a very important part of women's work that has simply been completely avoided. People don't look at it. They don't realize how much money is involved. They don't realize what a powerhouse it is. And so her documentary really investigates it from the readers, from the publishers, from the writers, from all different sides.
I think in general, people weren't really aware of the kind of money that was spent on romance fiction, well, on books in general, until a certain book, a shady book that I don't like to mention its name, but yeah. which made so very, very much money. But I it's not, that's not what you would consider romance fiction, is it?
Well, that properly is identified as erotic fiction.
Yes.
Which is a different category. But yes, it did bring the whole category of women's writing into greater prominence.
Now, I know that you kept your romance writing a secret until you received tenure at Fordham University. But tell me, do you think they would have given you tenure if you had told them beforehand?
No.
No?
No. They wouldn't have. And I'll tell you why. I mean, professors are the backbone of every department. I mean, we do tremendous amounts of committee work. We have so much work to do. And frankly, if one of my young colleagues said, oh yeah, I'm a Shakespearean, but actually I have been writing these bestsellers on the side, I would think that that person was going to become more interested in their writing career than they were in being a professor, which would mean that once tenured, they would leave those of us who do work in the department to do all the work, and they would simply refuse to do it. And we all have colleagues who are like that in no matter what field you're in. And I think that bias would have operated. It's not a bias against romance as such, but it's a bias against people who are holding down another complete job. As it happens, I'm primarily a Shakespeare professor, and sort of the romance is on my side. It's on the side for me. But that, of course, wouldn't be true for everyone.
Well, I'm sure they're actually very happy now with the number of books that you've written. You can probably endow a chair or two, or maybe even an entire library. Like, okay, build me a building. You know, I've written another 10 bestsellers, so something like that. Because I know, of course, that you love books, having come from a family of book lovers. I know you've mentioned that you had a lot of books as a child.
We did, yeah. But I should say that Mary Higgins Clark is one of Fordham's most famous alumni. She was summa cum laude at Fordham, and she has indeed endowed part of the library. But there's a big difference between authors who sell millions and trillions of copies in hardcover and authors who sell a lot in paperback. So Mary's ability to endow a library is probably not commensurate with mine.
Well, you know, when I was a little girl, I was raised in Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and I know you're from Minnesota, so mm-hmm. we have sort of similar backgrounds. But when we moved to the big city, we moved to Detroit, and the first library I saw was McGregor Public Library, and was mm-hmm. one of those big WPA buildings, you know, that they built right. solid. It was so beautiful, and, you know, for a kid coming from up north, well, you know, it was like, it was paradise. And when I walked in there with all the oak and the mahogany tables, and I used to dream that they would just lock me up in there over the weekend, and I could just spend my entire weekends in that library. Now, you had 5,000 books in as a child because your father and both your father and mother were writers, so that certainly must have influenced you.
It did. Though I have to say that your story brings back the Carnegie Public Library, which was in the town. I grew up on a farm outside a town of 2000, and there was a wonderful, solid Carnegie Public Library made out of sandstone or granite, or I don't know. But anyway, I thought it was heaven on earth, that place. And that, of course, is where the romance were, because my parents were literary writers, and they were very much set against genre fiction. So there was no genre fiction in my household. The closest romance got to romance was indeed Jane Austen.
Well, when I first got into the McGregor Public Library, I turned to the left and I started at the A's, and I went right around the entire room until I finished every book in the what they call the young people section. But I still remember it, and one of the saddest things for me is that, you know, with all the problems in Detroit, one day what they did is they just covered all the shelves with plastic.
Oh.
They left all the books, and they boarded up the building, and there it sits.
Oh.
And it just drives me crazy, and I just wish somebody would come along and do something about it, because it breaks your heart to think of the rain dripping, you know, melted snow dripping from the ceilings onto those books.
Right.
Yeah, you know, I'm here in Tampa, and we had a very interesting romance fiction book tour, signing tour. We had 60 romance fiction writers here, and it was called Beach Babes Book Blast.
Was it 60? Did you say 60?
60, yes.
Whoa, that's
and
a lot.
It was a lot. It was quite an amazing, amazing book fair. It was the first one that we've done here. And as I said, it was called Beach Babes Book Blast, which is a difficult name to say. But what made it so interesting is that many of the writers brought with them their cover models, you know, those big hunky guys.
mm-hmm.
So, yeah. You know, as you can imagine, the readers were thrilled to see all of the cover models. Now, of course, in your case, you travel with your own Italian knight. So tell us a little bit about him.
Well, he's a professor. He's the chair of Italian at Rutgers University. And I wouldn't say that he would consider himself at all a cover model. But
he's romantic.
Indeed, he is Italian, and he's very romantic, and we've been married a long time at this point. But I met him in a blind date, which is kind of a romantic detail.
It is. And to have a real cavaliere, right?
Yeah, a true cavaliere.
That's right. And he could whisper all of those romantic things in Italian, so that really that really makes it thrilling. But it's nice, I hear that he also is a great help to you, and you're one of these authors with deadlines constantly.
I am.
And he's always ready to pitch in there for you.
Yeah, you know that that book Lean In, and that woman who wrote it, Cheryl, one of the things that really moved me and lean in was when she said she couldn't have done it without her husband, that the husband has to lean in as well. And I'm sure you know he passed away 2 days ago. And I've been thinking about her a lot because I could not do this without Alessandro. Having this kind of a job with the high pressure of being a bestseller for book after book means that my husband has had to lean in a lot on our family life. At the same time, he's the chair of the department of his university. So it's a joint decision if someone takes on a job like this. And I feel very lucky.
Yeah, and it is a joy, too, because like I'm sort of in the same position. I always have deadlines, and my husband is my Prince Charming. He's not a knight, but he's a Prince Charming to me.
Right.
Tell me, your books always highlight independent women and, you know, mostly well-born women, for example, like Lady Zenobia in 3 Weeks with Lady X, and she was an interior decorator, and all of your women are strong, and how much of that comes from your mother, who was also a writer who really wrote, her stories were generally about ordinary women who face life's crises with, you know, strength and intelligence. And so how much of your mother comes into play when you think of writing your characters?
Oh, a tremendous amount. I mean, your mother shapes you so much. And I was growing up in a farm town, and she always worked. She wrote all the time when I was growing up. And she left a legacy for all of us children that said, your life is not just about making dinner and, you know, changing diapers. You need to create something with your life, and you need to work hard at creating. That was the real thing, I think, that she taught me, was that you can do anything if you work hard enough at it. And she really believed that, and she installed that in all of us. And I have 3 siblings, so we all absorbed that lesson very well.
And she wrote, I think it was funny when I first invited you to be on the show, I did not make the connection to your, you know, your family name, Bly. And I knew, once I got it, I said, I know I have her mother's book. Now, I have 4,000 books, and unfortunately, I've never had the time to put them all in order. So I had to really go digging and digging. But eventually, I found Beyond the Writer's Workshop, which I know is a book that is you know, so well loved by writers and by, you know, in colleges. For people studying writing. I'm going to take a little short break, and then we'll be right back. And this is Patsy Gill's Joy on Paper, and we'll be right back. This is Tampa Bay's TAN Talk Radio Network.
This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
Hi, I'm John Rakowski with Charles Ruttenberg Realty. Don't you love living here in the Tampa Bay area? Oh, I'm sorry, you don't live here yet? Well, if you already are or thinking about it, call me at my office at 727-538-9200 extension 2 for any real estate needs, including a free market analysis of your home. Your home is worth more than you can imagine. Call me today at 727-538-9200 extension 2. I'm John Rakowski.
It's almost Mother's Day. When you shop for the perfect gift, think quality. Think about buying something that your mother or your wife will treasure forever. Don't go to the mall. Go to the Silver Queen, located on West Bay, where you will find the perfect gift that will last a generation. Gifts that say you really care. Gifts that show you have good taste. This is Patsy with a Z. For listeners of TAN Talk Radio, the Silver Queen will give you a 20% discount on all your purchases this week, not just for Mother's Day, but for weddings and graduations that are coming up in the next few months. Just mention my name, Patsy with a Z, and TAN Talk Radio. For all you dads, are you taking your kids out to do some shopping? Go to the Silver Queen. They have so many wonderful gifts that are below $20. And with your 20% discount, it's a great savings. Remember, the Silver Queen on 1350 West Bay in Largo.
This is Dr. Bittaker, your new host on Natural Health in You. This is a call-in radio program designed to give you information about the complementary alternative healthcare field. You got questions about vitamins, minerals, enzymes, acupuncture, chiropractic, nutrition in general? Then call in every Saturday on WTM between 3 and 4 p.m. and ask a question. That's every Saturday between 3 and 4 p.m. Also, you can go to our website, naturalhealthandyou.com. You can sign up for our free newsletter at that time and see just exactly what we do.
If you would like to become a wholesale buyer of the premium quality longevity products you hear about right here on the Tantalk Radio Network for personal service, you can call Pete Greenway at 501-538-3160. That's Pete Greenway at 501-538-3160. And remember to tell him Lola sent you. Or you can go online at TantalkHealth.com. That's TantalkHealth.com. Here's to your health and longevity.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and we're back with my guest, Eloisa James, the author of 24 bestsellers, who is speaking to us from England. Hi, Eloisa.
Hello.
Great. Listen, thinking about England and romance writers, Jane Austen was self-educated, and mostly from her father's collection of books, and he was very supportive of her writing. Now, your father is, of course, Robert Bly, who himself is a famous writer. He wrote a book called Iron John, which was on the New York Times bestseller list for over 60 weeks. How does he feel about you being the Duchess of historical romance?
My dad has always been very supportive. It's just funny because he's such a literary person himself. But my stepmother actually read some of my early novels aloud to him, skipping all the sex parts, but... He always enjoyed them, and, you know, he has dementia now, but he still remembers who I am, and he still remembers poetry. But one of the interesting things is he always says to me, and I was just home 2 weeks ago, he says, how's it going in the writing world? He's endlessly interested in my career and how that works, even though it's been so different from his.
Yes, well, he's so famous. He won the 1968 National Book Award for Poetry. And so it must have been interesting childhood for you.
Well, I mean, we didn't have television, and it was pretty much a life that revolved around books. My parents both thought about books all the time, and the dinner table conversation was often around poetry. So my dad would say, "What do you think of this line of Yeats?" And we would all sit there and think, "Ugh." For many years, he was interested in fairy tales, and so he would bring up new fairy tales at dinner every night, and that's one of the reasons that led to my rewriting fairy tales. So I rewrote, for example, When Beauty Tamed the Beast is a version of Beauty and the Beast, and part of that comes from the many years that he spent saying, you know, why do you think that Jack climbed the beanstalk? Those kind of questions he was very interested in. And, of course, that made it very easy for me to rewrite fairy tales because I already had that thinking in mind.
You wrote, what, 5 or 6 books in the fairy tale?
Yeah.
Yeah, very nice. Tell me, when you started the Duchess series, did you realize it was going to go on so long that this is now your 8th book? The Four Nights with the Duke is the 8th book, correct?
Yeah, no, I had absolutely no idea. My idea was that I would write 4 books, but I was going to carry on these interlocking stories, very sort of Dickensian, you know, because I was thinking of the way Dickens brought his books out in just parts and then everyone would wait. So these interlocking stories, the problem with that is, at, you know, page 600, you realize that you can't finish all your interlocking stories in time. So I remember calling my editor and saying, well, I'm going to need 2 more books. And she said, well, that's 6. That's a lot of books. And then there was quite a lot. Those were Georgian books. And then, I don't know, 5 or 6 years went by. And I wrote 2 more that go in the same series.
Well, I have a feeling you're going to be carrying on through the Regency into the Victorian. And maybe, I don't know if you'll someday get into the modern fiction. Have you tried modern romances?
I have not. Yeah. No, because I'm a Shakespeare professor, yeah. I teach people walking and talking in the past. And so it's very hard for me to write a contemporary voice.
Well, isn't it? It's one of the fun things about writing historical fiction is the research that you have to do. It's so much fun to do research. I know, speaking of libraries, I spend a great deal of time at the British Museum, the reading room at the Old British Museum, which I don't know if you realize that they now put a glass. Have you been to the?
I've been to the old reading room.
Yeah. Well, you know, they put glass there now. You can't get into the reading room, which is where you know so many great writers sat. Besides, mm-hmm. Of course, Karl Marx sat there for years writing away, and it was just such a joy. And I think it was a terrible that they broke that tradition of allowing real writers to sit in that room, because it was you felt the ghosts of all these great writers before you. But you do a lot of research.
I do, yeah.
And tell us, like, for example, I love that story about the pineapple.
Right. Well, so I moved to England for a year. I was really running Fordham's program here in London. But then, of course, I was doing a lot of research in the way you're talking about. And a lot of that involves just go somewhere, hear the tour, learn as much as you can, and see what comes up. And I went to a house in Bath, a historical house in Bath, and they pointed to a pineapple, and they explained that a pineapple was so expensive that back in the day, you would actually rent the pineapple for your dinner party. You would not actually own a pineapple. You couldn't afford to have it. So one pineapple might travel between, I don't know, 5 or 10 households. So I instantly thought, this is wonderful. And in fact, I ended up building an entire book about it. And my next book will be called An American Duchess, My American Duchess. And it's about an American who comes over and doesn't know the rules and eats the pineapple.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yes.
So, but each book, how long does it take you to write a book? Are you like, do you write just... let yourself go and don't pay attention to word count. Yeah, and some writers, I was talking to one writer recently, and he knows exactly how many words he wants in each chapter, and he sets himself a timer, and that's it. And if it's not there, he doesn't care. He goes on to the next chapter. Or do you just let it flow and then start cutting when at the end?
That sounds very, very organized on his part. I'm not that organized. I write about one book every 9 months or one a year, depending on how my other job is going. At the moment, I wrote American Duchess faster because I'm not teaching this spring. But I can write and write and write, and I have to cut later. I think one of the hardest things about writing genre fiction is that you have to have the pacing right. It's a book in which someone needs to escape, and if they get bored, it's over. So for the last couple of books in particular, I've cut about 100, 150 pages out of each of them, which means I have to way overwrite in order to be able to cut down to make the book move fast enough.
Well, one of the things that new writers often don't realize is that when they finish a book, that's not the end of the process. There is that process of editing and having to fine-tune. And it helps if you have a great editor. So, I think whoever you're working with is doing a great job with you because your books are so clean by the end. You know, they exactly what you said. The pacing is right. They move very nicely. Yeah. And I know that you have so many fans, which of course is such an important thing. You know, you can be the greatest writer in the world, but without the readers. You are is poor, very poor.
Well, and unread. That's also important. I mean,
exactly.
We don't write just to put it under your bed. So
one of the, nowadays, of course, every writer needs this platform. They need to do things. They need to not just write. They have to be able to promote their books. And you've become a real master at it. I know that you're very involved in social media. Mm-hmm. What are your favorite forms of social media?
Well, I really enjoy Facebook. Facebook allows you a little bit more space than Twitter does. And I enjoy interacting with my readers a lot. I think that writing is a different business than it used to be. Now, we are able to take advantage of readers, and I mean that in the best possible way, to listen to what they're saying to us and to change based on it. I think one of the most damaging things a genre fiction writer can do is say to themselves, well, this is the book of my heart, and everyone's going to love it, and not listen to what readers are saying about, you know, what kind of things they'd love to see you write, for example. So for me, that's a very valuable resource, and I also just enjoy it because writing is a lonely business, and you spend a lot of time going, this is terrible, this is terrible, this is terrible. It's very nice to go onto Facebook and hear someone say, I stayed up all night and read your book. It gives you the sustenance to keep going.
Now, when I know that you attend book fairs like all writers do nowadays, you enjoy getting out there and meeting with the fans and talking to them?
I do, yeah. Yeah, I'm about to go off to RT Book Club in Dallas. And that's a huge conference with tons of readers. And it's really fun. And I am particularly excited because I'm leading a workshop in how to make a fascinator. You know, those little hats with feathers?
Oh, that's, I love those things.
Yeah, it's going to be so much fun. And my assistant bought tons of feathers and beads and little hats. And everybody's going to be gluing and sewing and just having a fabulous time for an hour. And we're all going to create amazing fascinators and, you know, wear them out of there proudly, I hope. So
that's a clever idea. Oh, you're gonna have lots of people coming to that.
Yeah.
That's nice. I like that. It's almost for romance, I think it's almost better than bringing down hunky cover models.
Yeah.
tell me, when you are advising, do you do some workshops for writers where you advise them what to do and how to do it, that type
of thing? I do. Yep. I'm teaching a class in Tuscany outside Florence in early June. But I also go to, say, the RWA, which is the Romance Writers of America, and halfway through July is a big conference in New York City. And I'm actually on three workshop panels there. I think romance writers as a whole are very, very involved in paying it forward. But it's also a selfish thing. I need people to be writing good romance so that when I'm not publishing a book, my reader can find really great books to read. Otherwise, she's going to skive off and go do, you know, something else, like learn how to skydive or something. So I need there to be books for her. So there is self-interest involved, too. I do my absolute best to teach people how everything I've learned about romance in 20 years of writing it.
When you were in the documentary, one of the things that they were talking about is how important it is for women to find their strength in writing, to mm-hmm. not just exactly what you said, to pay it forward, to not just write, but actually to get out there and be committed to the society and be committed to working with new writers and promoting books in general.
Mm-hmm.
So you're off to Tuscany. So tell us a little bit about Tuscany. Have any of your books been centered in Tuscany? I don't.
Okay. No, they're not. My books are centered in England.
They're all in England.
Yeah, they are all in England. That's really my place of expertise. But, you know, my husband is in Florence. We have an apartment there. And this is a wonderful program. It's called Minerva Education. And they have, you know, I'm coming out as the romance author. And then there's someone who teaches YA coming directly after me. And we do 9 or 10 days in a beautiful little hotel deep in the country outside a sweet little town. And it basically it's just me and 10 writers. And I like that because I can really work one-on-one with people, which I think is a very helpful way of teaching.
Now, let's just tell my listeners, your website address is?
www.eloisajames.com.
Okay, and everybody can go to Amazon and find your books. There are so many of them, and I'm... One of the things is I was looking at you had a year off in Paris and you wrote a little book about that time in Paris. How why did that book come about, and how did you find that year in Paris?
Well, what happened was my mother died of cancer, and I was diagnosed with cancer 2 weeks later. And so that can be a life-changing event. My breast cancer was not serious at all. But on the other hand, in that circumstance, it had a serious effect on me. And my husband and I ended up, we sold our house, we sold our cars, and we rented an apartment on the internet, and we went to Paris for a year. And it was a really wonderful year. We you know, uprooted our children, took them to Paris, put them in Italian school, and they both thrived. And that book is called Paris in Love. And it is about the year when we lived in Paris. And I think it was a fun book. I'm not sure I'm going to write one about the year we're in London right now. I don't think we'll write a version of London in Love because it was so much about my children. I wanted to capture that year in case I didn't survive. I think it's a impulse that all writers probably have at some point. But I really wanted to capture that year so they wouldn't forget. This year, my daughter is a teenager, and I think maybe better if we all forget.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being on my show today. I think that, you're an inspiration for writers to just get out there and keep trying, because you were rejected when you first started, right?
By tons. I was rejected by so many places.
No, really? I thought it was just one place. I didn't realize you were...
No. I could paper a wall. And here's one of the funniest things. One of those agents that rejected me in the beginning wrote on my letter about my first book and said, "This will never sell." And then later, when my book was coming out in hardcover and there was a huge cocktail party being thrown for it, I ran into him in the hall. And he looked at me and he said, "I guess I was wrong." You know, that was one of the happiest moments of my life.
Delicious. That is delicious.
Every one of the writers who are listening to your show, that, you know, they're doing exactly the right thing because they're listening to your show and they're hearing from writers, which is so important. They're getting tips, but they have to keep the faith and believe that at some point that agent who's rejected them will look at them and say, "I guess I was wrong."
Oh, that is a delicious thing to look forward to for every mm-hmm. writer. I know I've had some, you know, great agents. I had Irene Goodman from the Irene Goodman Agency, and next week I have another great agent. And writers are looking for what they have to do to get through to the agents. And so, you know, it's nice to know that your first query letter doesn't always work.
No, definitely not.
So and it's lovely now to get for you that you've gotten to this point that you're in such great demand, and it's inspirational. And I want to thank you so much for talking to my listeners today. And I know that they will enjoy your books. I as you said, some of where the lady was saying, well, she couldn't stop; she had to read it all night, and that's true, because your books are really, they're very intricate. Sometimes, you know, you think, oh, well, they're almost too intricate. But then you, like, click onto one thing and you say, oh, wow, this is good. And then you turn the page and you want to know the rest of the story. And I sort of described it your books are like chocolate eclairs. You want, you know, the one is really great and it's satisfying for a while, but you know, you want another one, you know. You just want to keep turning the pages. And so it's funny, my local library here, they have, you know, not a shelf for your books. They have like almost a whole row for your books, because your books are all out there in both regular version, and then so it's wonderful how they do these large print books. Mm-hmm. And so they have like a whole entire bookshelf with the large print books, which people just enjoy so much. Are they on audio too, your books, or not?
Yeah, they're on audio. Yep.
Wow. Okay.
All on audio, and so anyone can listen to Eloisa James in any mode that they want. Really.
Okay. Well, I don't know, some of those parts must have made the readers blush. You know, what do you think, before I let you go, what do you think Jane Austen would think about today's fiction? Do you think it's way above what she would would have imagined it could ever happen?
I think she would be very surprised to see what has sprung from her books, in essence, because in a way she is the progenitor of Regency romance. I think, though, that she would probably want to offer a disclaimer, because, of course, she was a lady. She was meant to the gentry, and I'm pretty sure she would faint if she read one of my books.
Well, luckily, your readers don't, and your readers just keep coming back for more. And so the most recent one was out in March, and I'm sure you're going to have another one sometime.
In February.
So
My American Duchess will be out in February of 2016.
Oh, well, we will look forward to that. And maybe you'll come back on the show and you can talk to us about that again, because it sounds fascinating. And I know that you must have done a lot of research for it. So again, thank you so much, Eloisa. Mary Bly.
And my best to everyone listening. I hope you all publish and thrive and love your writing at the same time.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
It's easy to shop for Mother's Day when you know that you want to buy quality. Visit the Silver Dome, located at 1350 West Bay, under the Silver Dome. This is Patsy with a Z, the host of Joy on Paper. My sponsor, the Silver Queen, will give you a 20% discount on all your purchases this week. Just mention my name and Tan Talk Radio. They have the perfect gift for you, with designer names that will never go out of fashion. You will find the perfect gift, a unique gift that says that you care. So go to the Silver Queen and tell them that Patsy sent you, and enjoy your 20% discount.
Charles Ruttenberg Realty proudly sponsors Joy on Paper with Patsy Gill. Charles Ruttenberg sets the standard of excellence with residential and commercial real estate transactions and can help you on your next transaction, whether that is for a second home, investment, or downsizing. Call us today at 727-538-9200 extension 2 and allow me to help you. I'm John Rakowski, the broker at Charles Ruttenberg Realty.
Have you been struggling with family conflict, depression, or trauma? Has something been keeping you up at night, causing excessive stress and worry? Tune in to Moments of Clarity every Wednesday night at 8. After over 10 years as a psychotherapist, I realized how important it is to take the stigma out of seeking professional help. So tune in Wednesday nights at 8 p.m. The call to me can be a great first step. It may just be exactly what you need to hear.
Hi, it's Mike Riso, one of the professional golf instructors at Clearwater Country Club. Our daily golf tips are here to help you improve your game as simply and quickly as possible. Tune in each morning and we'll have a fresh new golf tip that'll help you with your putting, chipping, pitching, and sand shots, and lower your scores at distance and boost your confidence too. Like to play Clearwater Country Club? We're open to the public, and afternoon rates start at only $26.95. We're conveniently located on North Petty Lane off Drew Street. For tee times, call the Pro Shop at 727-461-4188 or find us on the web at clearwatercountryclub.com.
The city of Dunedin introduces baseball done our way. Start with a morning on our pristine beaches. Next, off to downtown for some unique shopping. Then a bit of lunch at one of our many award-winning restaurants. And now, time for an afternoon game at Florida Auto Exchange Stadium. Finish the day off with a sunset cruise on the Gulf. A day in Dunedin. A day done our way. For more information, go to DunedinGov.com.
This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z. Welcome back to Joy on Paper. It was great to speak to Eloisa James from London. I hope that you will be with us next week when I have two guests, David Ellis, an entertainment and intellectual property lawyer, who will answer your questions. You can call in next week or email me in advance your questions at patsy.radio@gmail.com. Dave recently spoke about copyrights for screenwriters at a meeting of the Actors, Screenwriters, Artists, and Crew Production Group. Dave has also spoken at many seminars discussing writers' rights, and he holds workshops. One of his workshops was called Great Ideas, Learn How to Protect Yours and Establish a Brand. So be ready with your questions. You can go to my website, www.radio-joyonpaper.com, and there is a contact form there to submit your questions. Learn how to protect yourself. Have you created characters that you want to protect? Do you want to hire someone to turn your book into a script? Have you written a children's book and want to know what kind of contract you need with an illustrator? All of these questions and more can be answered by Dave Ellis next week when he's on my program. So tune in and get his good advice. Now, I have another guest next week, and I'm going to play her a little song.
Sincerely yours, sincerely yours.
I'll be yours, sincerely yours. All my life, sincerely yours. Night and day, I'll pray you're mine. Spring or fall, rain or shine.
That song always reminds me of agents, literary agents. Because as writers, that is how we feel about agents. We are sincerely theirs. When we write a query letter, all we can do is dream that they will actually read it and like it, and then that they will contact us. So we do pray that they are ours, and we do want to always tell them that we will be their friends when everybody else forgets them. We will be there and be their friends. So I'm happy that next week my guest will be Lane Zachary. She's a founder of Zachary Schuster Harmsworth. Doesn't that sound impressive? I'm sure that every writer would like to have it roll off their tongues. Zachary Schuster Harmsworth. They are one of the premier New York City literary agencies, with a client list of top quality and best-selling authors. And Lane is going to give us great advice on how to write a query letter, what an agent's looking for today in both nonfiction and fiction. They have such a wide range of agents in their firm, and so it will be very interesting. She will also tell us what agents we might be able to submit material to. So do listen in next week to Lane Zachary and find out what we can do and what every writer has to do in order to find a New York agent. Now, several years ago, I moved from my house to my condo. And as I mentioned to my earlier guest, I have 4,000 books. Now, the books I could not sell. Of course, I had to take them with me. But I was amazed at the amount of objects I had in the house that really, you know, they were nice, but they weren't of any value. And so I landed up having this garage sale. As a matter of fact, I think in the garage sale, I sold mostly objects. I don't think I pulled out a few books that I was going to sell, but then as I was holding the garage sale, I'm sitting in the garage in the driveway waiting for customers, I started reading the books again, and I said, well, I can't sell this one, and I can't sell this one, and I can't. So I landed up putting all the books back in the house and eventually taking them with me. But when you look at the things that you think were nice, and you know, whether it's photo frames or little tchotchkes or knickknacks, and then you realize, you know, those are nice, but it would be so much nicer if you had bought and if you'd spent your money on things that were going to last, things that would keep their value. And that's why I'm so happy that one of my sponsors is the Silver Queen. They're just, they have in that store such an amazing collection of objects that will never, ever land up being in a garage sale. They are the type of objects that you will treasure forever. So if you are looking for a Mother's Day gift, I really urge you to go there this week. The one thing a mother never has enough of are photos of their children or their grandchildren and nieces and nephews. And they have some of the most beautiful photo frames I have ever seen. I'm just amazed. I have not seen anything in this area to compare. These are photo frames that you would see in Paris or in London. And they're just delightful. And so if you're looking for a lovely gift that you know is top quality and will last and be saved, not just for your mother, but it'll be saved down and handed down generation after generation, you really should take a trip to the Silver Queen. It's located at 1350 West Bay. They've been wonderful in sponsoring this program, which is so helpful to all the people out there who are writers and dream of writing. It's for me, what they're doing this week is they're offering a 20% discount. So anybody who goes and shops this week will get a 20% discount. So think about it. If you want quality, head to the Silver Queen and get something really beautiful, something that will last forever. And remember, you have to mention my name, Patsy with a Z, and Tan Talk Radio, and you'll get a 20% discount.
Let me ask you a question. There's a lot of people ask me about audio tapes and stuff like that, you know, from the old days. Is there a process, or is it going to be a process of putting, like, older books to save them, putting them on e-books?
As a matter of fact, there is. First of all, Google has taken all of the very old books that are out of copyright, and they're putting them online, and they plan eventually to have them all in audio version.
What about a book that you have at home that's falling apart and you wanted to preserve it or something like that? Is there a program you can buy or anything like that?
No, I don't. I'm not aware of anything.
Okay,
like
I'll
that.
Have to research that, because I know I've got a lot of books that are falling apart, and I'm wondering if there's a way to save them.
Whoa, that's a great idea. You know,
hey, we can go on Shark Tank.
Exactly. That's an excellent idea. You know, this is America, and people come out with solutions for everything. So that's a wonderful idea. And that's Big Ed in there. You know, Big Ed is my producer, control room guy, and he is amazing. And they call him Big Ed, I think, because if the guests
it's
don't
my
show
shoe size.
You know, no, I think if the guests don't show up, he comes after them. Anyway, thank you, Big Ed, and thank you. This is Patsy with a Z, and I'm wishing you all a great week. Remember that one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken on stage or screen. So this week, get motivated, take some time and write one page at a time. In a month, you'll have your first chapter. Join me next Tuesday at 11 a.m. for Joy on Paper. Remember, joy is not an option. It is an order. So find your joy and share it. Bye.